Thanks for dialing in to the WGN Wintrust Business Lunch, produced by Pete Zimmerman. This is John Williams. We're glad that you were there. We start on Thursdays with our job report sponsored by Breezy.hr. And out of the gate, it's Brian Battle, the Director of Performance for Trust Capital's Partners. Nope, I'll say it again. Brian Battle is the Director for Performance Trust Capital Partners. Visit performancetrust.com. Hey, Brian, welcome to WGN. How are you?
I'm great, John. Thanks for having me back.
Give me some jobless numbers now. What's your read on them?
Right. So today is Thursday, the first Thursday of the month, and we have initial jobless claims. So how many people filed for a jobless claim for the first time? And that number was 340,000 people, which is the lowest it's been since March of 2020, which is the beginning of the pandemic. Another important number, too, that came out today was continuing claims. How many people filed for a claim, not the first time, but maybe the second or the third or the fourth time? And that was 2.7 million people. What's interesting is that those numbers are going down. So that means there's less unemployment in the U.S. There's more and more people getting jobs. And the numbers today sets up for the real important number tomorrow, which is the non-farm payrolls number. It comes out the first Friday of the month. And that's a number that the whole market and the members of the Federal Reserve are watching to see what is the status of employment in the U.S. because of all the static and all the noise we've been through the past year, you know, with the pandemic and all this federal stimulus. How many people are working is a real number and something you can discern information from.
I thought that the number of unemployed people is closer to 9 or 10 million.
That's right. So there's a bunch of different ways to cut employment or unemployment. There's payroll. There's private payrolls, public payrolls, unemployment rate, number of how many people are actually in the labor pool. So there's a bunch of different ways to cut it. So the number that you're talking about is like a gross number. So what's interesting there is there's about 7 million people that are there are millions of jobs that need people, and there are millions of people still on unemployment benefits because of the unprecedented federal stimulus. So, like I said, there's a lot of noise in the statistics, and one number that's really, really been consistent is the non-farm payrolls number, which is a consistent measurement that's been used over time to try and drill down to like how many people are actually working or not working.
And in aggregate, would you say that these numbers are pointing in the right direction, and are they pointing in the right direction as quickly as we would like?
So the most important thing is time. We're leaving this era of pandemic and global lockdown. Remember, the virus didn't kill the U.S. economy. It's quarantine did. You know, we closed our economy on purpose as a matter of public policy. So as we unwind that, that's going to be unprecedented. There's going to be a lot of weird things that happen. One of the weird things that's happened is it takes a lot longer to start up a factory than it does to close it down. And the other thing is the Washington, D.C. sent a lot of money gushing into the states. It's trillions. I mean, with a T. I mean, it's a giant number. That has also distorted the employment statistics and how fast businesses get back. So that's why this recession didn't feel that bad, and closing the economy didn't feel that bad, because trillions of dollars have been flowing out of Washington, D.C. So they definitely smoothed it out. But as we exit, you know, and something we'll talk about hopefully in a minute, is we're getting into another budget season, where do we need more federal money? And the Federal Reserve, who sets interest rates in the U.S., is deciding whether we need to raise interest rates because things are getting better.
Yeah, let's talk about that. And by the way, future generations, sorry. So talk about that. What do you want to say about that?
So the Federal Reserve is deciding. So we've had unprecedented monetary policy since the last financial crisis, 2008, 9, 10, 11, 12, where we held rates really, really low. And it is willfully we are punishing savers to benefit borrowers, to try and get the economy back going again. We've held rates really, really low. When I say we, I mean the Federal Reserve. And so it is a time now maybe to exit that policy. So the Federal Reserve buys a lot of Treasury bonds. They keep rates really, really low, and everybody feels that in their savings and checking account. That is going to cause some disruption. As rates start to rise, that's going to hurt different people differently. So one of the numbers, and we're bringing all this up to your point, is that one of the numbers the Federal Reserve looks at is the unemployment number, which is coming out tomorrow. And the Federal Reserve chairman, a guy named Jerome Powell, said, we're watching the unemployment number, and we're probably going to start raising rates in the near future. He's very obtuse about what that means, maybe November, maybe next year. whatever, we're starting to get to that point where it's going to start going the other way, which has been met with an unbelievable amount of apathy in the market because we're up a little bit today and the bond market really hasn't changed much. And it's curious to us, the guys have been doing this for a long time, that sort of change in policy isn't causing more disruption, but I guess we're going to wait for it to actually happen to see that disruption. We're ending a very, very interesting time.
Yeah, well, I'm interested in hearing what you have to say about it down the road then. Brian Battle, Director of Performance Trust Capital Partners, performancetrust.com. Well done, Brian. Thanks for your time today.
You're welcome, John.
The Wintrust Business Lunch continues with Ian Schur, Editor-at-Large at CNET.com. Hi, Ian. How are you today?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
Good. Let's jump right into it. Windows 11's release date is what, and when are we going to see it?
It's happening on October 5th, and I think what's really interesting is that this is the software, you know, when you start up a computer, you get that do-do-do, right, the kind of entry noise, and then you've got the start menu and the desktop. That's what Windows is. And Microsoft hasn't changed it in, like, 6 years. Like significantly. And so this most recent version, which they're going to come out with on October 5th, it'll be free and they'll be rolling it out slowly. So if you have a computer that is compatible, which means it was made in the last few years, you'll get the update sometime in the next 6 months. The biggest changes you'll notice are actually that it's going to feel a lot more like a tablet. Right, that all the images are a little bigger, all the buttons are a little larger, even the places you can hit the X, right, to close a window are slightly larger. And this is kind of a response, I think, to a lot of how people have been using technology lately and how popular tablets have gotten, even if you don't own one, but just how the way that they work has kind of become part of the mainstream.
Maybe it's also a function of the age of the people that are using the devices.
You definitely hit on something there, too. And truth is that more and more people who are using these devices, you know, they grew up in the phone age, right? And it's a little scary to think about how old the young people are, right? And how old I am by comparison. But that's what's going on. For a lot of them, yeah, this is the only world they've ever known.
What does Amazon have to do with this veterinary medicine that people are taking?
It probably almost everyone at this point has heard of ivermectin. If you don't know about it, we actually have a very good breakdown on it on CNET, and we've won awards for our COVID coverage, so we try very hard to make sure we are accurate. But what's interesting is that Amazon, you know, it's not a place you think of as a place of disinformation, but one of the unfortunate things is that they have a system running, a program in the background, that tries to show you things that are popular. So what happened is a bunch of people went on Amazon to try and buy ivermectin, and as a result, it started shooting to the top of lists, and it even if you just type in IV, right, you weren't going to get other things. You get ivermectin as the first fill-in response. And this has, of course, led to a lot of criticism of Amazon for benefiting from, you know, something that is literally the government is warning is poisoning people. And it's a huge problem. The company says that they've responded, but it just speaks to how automated computer programs can screw up so badly in these days.
Well, I'm sorry, I'm not going to be able to buy it online from Amazon anyway, am I? I mean, the fact that in my Google search, if I type IV, I think that comes up, maybe because I want to know what the news is about this. So I don't know
right.
That bothers me on Google. Why do I care that it does that on Amazon?
Well, unfortunately, it was buyable on Amazon for a while. People were selling it, and that's part of the problem right there.
Yeah.
But also, you know, we're dealing with a situation where, look, Amazon is enormous, and it has a bunch of people on there who the company tries to stop from scamming people, but there are scammers on Amazon, and you have to look out sometimes. And this is one of those situations where people who are vulnerable, and I mean vulnerable not just in the normal way, but also they've been informed wrong, can be taken advantage of. And that's problematic in and of itself.
I get that, Ian. Is there any consequence then to the right-wing personalities, the Laura Ingrams, the Joe Rogans of the world? I mean, is anybody saying or doing anything about their advocacy for this?
You know, right now, I think most of the response has been that the government is warning people not to take it, which unfortunately, a lot of people who are predisposed to not believe the government are just going to ignore that. But also that there is an ongoing effort by a lot of media out there to point out when lies are spread. And I mean, I'm doing it right now, right? And I think that that's an important thing, too, is to point out what the actual facts are and to continue reminding people, because they're going to hear about this one way or another, you know, this is where the actual science is versus the hooey you might have heard.
Well, and I think there's plenty of us who by this point have thought, you know what, that's on you now. We've done everything we can. If you want to take drugs for animals and it kills you or harms you, that's on you. Too bad if you're in the healthcare profession, but I think the sympathy card has been played for a lot of people. Talk to us about what China is doing with kids' use of devices.
Yeah, this is really interesting. You know, the Chinese government increasingly has been really pushing to try and kind of take on the tech industry. We've seen, for example, that they've limited amount of investment tech companies are allowed to make recently in the country, or even trying to go public outside the country. And now what they've done is that they've actually limited the amount of time that kids can play video games. This newest rule that they've put out says that they can only play 3 hours per week. That's 1 hour on Friday, 1 hour on Saturday, 1 hour Sunday, and only, by the way, between 8 and 9 p.m. They're being really specific. And part of the reason is that the Chinese government believes that video games are not good for children, despite a lot of evidence to the contrary. And also, I think it's kind of an interesting choice to make during the pandemic when a lot of people have turned to video games, not just as entertainment and not just as a way to turn off your brain, which they're very good at, but also as a place to socialize. You know, there are tons of stories, including on CNET, about how games like Fortnite have become the way that kids who otherwise can't see their friends are connecting with them. And that is important, too.
That's an interesting take, Ian, because I thought my only quibble was going to be with the amount of time they're allowed. But I also wonder, how do they monitor that? Is the Chinese government tapped into people's devices? Can they monitor it or control it?
The life of totalitarian regimes, right? So these games are online, which means that they're actually controlled by the companies, not your individual computer, right? You have to connect to them in order to use the game, right? Imagine Fortnite is a very good example of that, right? Where Fortnite doesn't work unless the company that runs it is actually still working, right? I can't use it if the internet goes down. So in this case, what's happening is that the companies are being told by the government, not only do they have to monitor these accounts, but also they have to verify who is playing the game and their age. And I don't mean like when Instagram asks you, are you 13 years old, and you just scroll to, you know, sometime in 1970s to say when your birthday is. This is actually making it so that they verify the actual kids' real names before they play the games. And that's something that would never fly here in the States, but it speaks to how far the Chinese government is trying to go to do this.
Instagram is going to ask for your birthday, though, right?
They are, yeah. And actually, this is a really interesting thing. They say that they're doing this because they're trying to cut down on the amount of targeted advertising in children. Of course, as I just pointed out, they're not going the level that the Chinese government is going. Instead, they're just going to ask, hey, what's your birthday? And, you know, a lot of kids who don't want to tell Instagram their birthday are just going to scroll to whatever is beyond 1989 and be done with it. And I think that is part of what is a problem here, right, is that, you know, we have these systems that are set up that are not legal if they're applied to children. And children very free-willingly use the Internet. I mean, we learned this with YouTube. YouTube was actually taken on by the Federal Trade Commission because they were tracking children's usage on YouTube when the children using their parents' accounts.
Out of time, Ian Schur, editor-at-large. Read more interesting thoughts like that at CNET.com. Thank you, Ian.
Thank you.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN. We're produced by Pete Zimmerman. The National Park Service is celebrating a grand opening of the Pullman National Monument Visitor Center and State Historic Site Grounds this weekend, Labor Day weekend. It'll include a number of events and things to see. How about that? The National Park Service. So let's visit with Sue Bennett, who is the assistant superintendent of what is now called the Pullman National Monument. Hey, Sue, you're on WGN. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having us this afternoon.
National Monument. So I think of things other places other than Chicago. Can you just tell us what this designation means? What are we talking about?
Sure. So in 2015, then President Obama created the National Monument with support from the city, state, community, and the National Park Service. And we were able to spend some time with one of our nonprofit partners, the Historic Pullman Foundation, while we worked to rebuild the historic Clock Tower Administration Building. And now it is open for a visitor center and our offices. We have been working with the state of Illinois to remediate and manage the grounds around the new visitor center and have put in some amenities, sidewalks, benches, some features back on the landscape and parking as well. And so really a lot of behind-the-scenes work to get the fence taken down and the building reopened. It's an 1880 building, and make it available for everybody here in Chicago and the nation to learn a little bit more about the Pullman story.
What is the Pullman story?
Well, it's a business program, so I thought we'd maybe start with the 1880 business model. George Mortimer Pullman was in the business of making rail cars. He relocated his shops from Detroit to South Chicago. At the time, it was outside of city boundaries and got some tax breaks that way. And he consolidated his rail car manufacturing. Part of his business model was also to rent the trains to railroads and provide the onboard exceptional staff. And additionally, he did a third thing that's the one that got him in a little bit of trouble. He decided to run a town for his workers to be able to work at the car works. And so when there was a big strike in 1894 during an economic recession, his workers in the town had to pay the same rents but were making less funds. So they decided to have a strike, asking for some relief with the company. It didn't happen. And it just happened at that time that the American Railway Union, a brand new consolidated union in Chicago, representing many of the railroad workers, not just one kind of railroad worker, picked up their cause. And this local Pullman strike for some relief for wages and rent in town became a national boycott over the summer of 1894, basically stopping commerce in the United States. And so you had a little bit of federal intervention at that time and a little bit of enforcement and troops. There were violence throughout the country in railroad yards, rail cars overturned. People lost their lives during this agitation. And so it's really the first time here in Chicago that that incident took that national significance. And that's what we talk about a little bit here in town. Since the strike, you know, we don't see a lot of corporations who are baking, building homes for their workers. They either are into manufacturing or development and running towns, but not both. And so once burned, twice shy, I guess.
So there at the Pullman National Monument, then, how much do I see? Do I see where the workers lived or any vestiges of the town? You have this visitor center. Talk to me a little bit about the experience then.
Today is a great time to come down and see from 103rd Street to 115th Street along South Cottage. Much of the original Pullman worker housing is still intact, and most of it is still actually privately owned and lived in. Mm-hmm. At the visitor center, you'll see the clock tower along with the state grounds, one of the state manufacturing wings, the remnant of another manufacturing bay, the historic Hotel Florence, also managed by the Illinois Department of Natural Resources, is there. And then we have a few other buildings like the Greenstone Church, the historic firehouse, the National A. Philip Randolph Pullman Porter Museum, and other partners bringing some of the historic homes into a museum setting, and we'll be bringing that online next spring. And so really you can come and walk around a community that is frozen in time. It looks like it's an 1880s, 1890s community. Urban planning, people still come here and look at the scale of building, the walkability of it, and are inspired for some of our current plans for live, work, play residential business areas.
When I come, I'll wear a hat and a coat and a tie the way they used to when people socialized back then.
No, yeah, some of those historic photos, the shop workers, even though you might be a lower-skilled shop worker, you came pretty well-dressed to come into the shops and work. Nope, today, just come with your comfortable walking shoes and comfortable clothes. this weekend. We're really excited to, as I said, peel back the fence and open the visitor center. We typically have a big event in this area on Labor Day, although the holiday didn't get nationalized because of the strike here at Pullman in 1894. Some states had already authorized it. It did become a federalized holiday during that summer of the Pullman labor strike. And so, you know, a lot of people like to say it's sort of the birthplace of our end of summer holiday. But here in Pullman, we honor the contributions of workers to the American fabric and the American economy. You'll get a chance to participate. There are free tickets to get a sneak peek in the visitor center. Of course, due to COVID, we need to be able to have smaller group sizes and limit the amount of time we can be inside. And those free tickets are available starting at 9 o'clock, both Saturday and Sunday. Also, a quick sneak peek of the first floor of Hotel Florence. The Illinois Labor History Society is doing walking tours twice each day. And then a nice partnership with Metra and Amtrak, UP, some of our partners, the Historic Pullman Foundation. There's a few historic rail cars that are going to be on the tracks here at the 111th Street Station with some limited tickets as well to get a chance to get inside those. And so these are all free, available first come, first serve. Our park webpage has a lot more information. And that's at www.nps.gov/pull, P-U-L-L.
Sue Bennett's the assistant superintendent for the Pullman National Monument, 11001. I always struggle with how to say these addresses when they have five digits to them. But 11001 South Cottage Grove Avenue. You can Google it, too, if you're just starting Pullman National Monument Visitor Center. Wow, Sue, the timing is perfect, and I'm excited to see it. Well done. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
She is the assistant superintendent there. It's also 12:45. The business news continues now. Here's Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Baxter International is buying Chicago-based Hillrom for $12.4 billion. Hillrom makes a range of hospital equipment, including stretchers, patient monitors, operating tables, and electrocardiographs. The CEO of Baxter, based in Deerfield, says Hillrom and Baxter share a common vision for transforming healthcare to better serve all patients and providers. Baxter will pay $156 a share for Hillrom. Amazon is on another hiring spree in the Chicago area with thousands of jobs to fill as it opens hubs in South Suburban Markham and Madison. Amazon will start hiring on September 10th, and the loading docks will be open by next month. That means those facilities will be up and running in time for the holiday shopping season. Amazon is offering starting pay at $16 an hour, plus extra for working the night shift. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Business of food, Steve Alexander.
Well, let's talk about coffee, John. Maybe you're having a midday pick-me-up right about now. Mm-hmm. Actually, this story is less about drinking coffee and more about how roasting and selling coffee is turning around the lives of military veterans who are having trouble getting back into the civilian ways of doing things. Chicago is home to Veteran Roasters, and Brendan Marty is the CEO and managing partner.
Well, this really got started outside of coffee, with more around how we, I'm a Navy veteran myself, how we could support other veterans that may have found some struggles in returning home.
Before taking over at Veteran Roasters, he worked with Rags of Honor, the clothing company founded by Mark Doyle 8 years ago after he returned from Afghanistan and saw what a problem homeless and jobless veterans was. With coffee having such a military connection with Cup of Joe, starting a veteran-run coffee company seemed like a natural way to help veterans navigate their return.
Whether it's chronic unemployment and kind of going from job to job, or dealing with housing insecurity, or really just kind of a support network, not really having that anymore. And so what we try to do is help solve all of those problems and get people back on their feet.
And all the while learning how to work in a non-military environment. Veterans do everything from selecting beans in Brazil and Papua New Guinea to roasting them in Chicago and packaging and selling them nationwide, mostly wholesale.
We work with, you know, all sorts of different types of businesses, large multi-unit restaurant groups nationally to offices.
You can enjoy a cup of Veteran Roasters coffee at Del Frisco Steakhouses in Chicago and nationwide, and in Chicago at Sweet and Tart, Marvin's Food and Fuel, and the Chicken and Egg restaurants. You can buy it online, too.
It's veteranroasters.com.
You can also buy t-shirts and other gear at that website. One of the shirts reads, and this is the slogan for the company, "They were on the ground for us, buy some grounds for them." veteranroasters.com. Chicago Board of Trade's in the green today, thanks to a weaker dollar. Right now, corn is trading about 2.25 cents higher. Beans are up 7, and wheat is up about 1.75 cents. From the farm to your belly, it's National Blueberry Popsicle Day, and also it's International Cabernet Sauvignon Day. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
Amy Guth joins us now. Let's start by talking about travel and business travel. What's the news, Amy?
Yeah, I thought this is a really interesting survey that Bloomberg did. They surveyed 45 just really very large companies, asking their leadership structure a little bit about what their plans were for business travel currently and post-pandemic. So of the 45 large companies, and these are American, European, and Asian companies, about 84% of them said that they plan to spend less on travel post-pandemic. They cited a number of reasons for that. They said, you know, we were able to, during, because we kind of had to scramble to figure something out, we came up with some technology solutions that they're, you know, we're not going to need to. Some one company was talking about using drones to fly over some of the production facilities, so that instead of doing a plant visit, you could just look and see what the drone is doing. But they also cited, of course, costs and worker well-being. A couple of them mentioned, you know, it's no small thing to go through time zones and have jet lag and schlep luggage and all those kind of things. So of the companies that said they were going to cut travel, it was not insignificant. It was kind of by a lot. They said that they would see reductions between 20 and 40%. And then 2 in 3 of them said they would be slashing both internal and external in-person meetings, and citing those reasons I outlined. So when we're talking about numbers, the Global Business Travel Association says corporate spending in 2019 was about $1.43 trillion for that kind of corporate travel, business travel, trips, and everything associated with it. And that could drop down to $1.24 trillion by about 2024. A couple of industry analysts who commented on this survey talked a little bit about, you know, we still have to kind of wait and see, and this is but one survey, but certainly the signs are there that this will come to bear. But really, they were predicting by 2023, that's when we kind of start to see the structure of the new normal and see what has the adaptation really brought, or was it pent-up demand and delay, and then it came back as we remember it.
You know, one thing I'm surprised is how significant the chip shortage remains. That's still in the news too, isn't it?
Yeah, it certainly is. And it's in the news pretty close to home. So the Belvedere assembly plant for Stellantis, they manufacture a Jeep Cherokee. That factory is down this week, and it will also be down next week and the week ahead. Auto Forecast Solutions kind of has been tracking all of this, and they say that the microchip shortage has cost automakers 2.1 million units of production in North America alone just through the week of August 23rd. So that's not even counting the other, the other factories that are going to be going dark in the week ahead. And it's not just Stellantis, and it's not just in Belvedere. Some of the other Stellantis plants are also going to be closing down temporarily. The Sterling Heights assembly plant in Michigan, that has about a little over 7,000 employees. They have 3 different shifts. They're going to be down for a week, and they had already had some downtime in July. This also includes some Canadian plants in Ontario, also under Stellantis. But when we're looking at other automakers, Ford's Dearborn truck plant, they are just going to operate one shift. And so we're seeing this from a lot of automakers. It still really continues to impact them quite a bit.
Update us on Burger King. Woo woo.
Right. Well, I kind of figured this was coming, but so McDonald's announced their loyalty program and rolled it out. And if you have the app, you've been seeing it. If you have the BK app, you might have already seen something about this too. But Burger King is launching a rewards program. They said it will be in all their stores by October. This is already, if you already order through the website or the mobile app, you might have already seen this because they rolled it out there first. But essentially, it's going to be, you get 10 crowns. It's called the royalty perks. So they have to go with crowns to keep the royal theme. You get 10 crowns for every dollar spent, and then you can redeem those points for upsizing, you know, your order, or getting daily kind of perks or special things from the menu, things like that.
I want the Burger King guy to show up. He's my favorite.
I know.
He's kind of creepy, but yep. That campaign for me works. Amy Guth does too on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thank you, Amy. We'll see you next week.
Thanks so much, John.